calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the studios of WPTT in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And tonight at 7 o'clock at the Borders in Monroeville, I'll be signing, doing a rant and signing my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. And speaking of what we can do about it, we can have more competent and progressive elected officials like Senator Bernie Sanders. It's the first hour of our Friday program. As always, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator, now sworn in officially, Senator Bernie Sanders, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Hey, Bernie, great to have you here with us. I understand you can only be with us for the first half hour of the program?
Maybe a little bit less than that.
Okay, all righty. So where do you want to start? Where do you want to start? And
well,
do you want to take calls during this first segment here?
Well, let's begin by kind of looking what's going on at D.C. right now. And the very good news, obviously, is the Democrats have taken control over the House and the Senate. And I think in a very significant direction, this means that right-wing extremism, as we have known it for the last 6 years under President Bush, is now over. Mm-hmm. I think it is unlikely that any absurd right-wing idea is going to get any traction, and that is very, very good. But the challenge that we now face, especially with a very, very small Democratic majority in the Senate, 51-49, and the fact that filibusters can prevent significant legislation from being passed unless you have 60 votes, means that we are going to have to mount very, very strong grassroots efforts, mobilizing the American people to start standing up for the middle class and for working families, start standing up to bring our troops home from Iraq as soon as possible, and to do all of the other things that we need to move America in a very different direction from where it has been going over the last 6 years. So we have a lot of work on our hands. Let me just mention one issue. There will be a lot of discussion in the coming months about the serious problem that we have with a national debt of over $8 trillion. This, in fact, is a huge issue. To my mind, it is a moral issue because it is wrong to leave to our kids and our grandchildren a huge debt. And what will happen if we don't address that huge debt is our political opponents will be proposing massive cuts in programs that benefit the middle class and working families and lower-income families. So it is very important that we deal with the national debt. What will happen unless we mobilize the grassroots is that I am afraid that the solution will end up being cuts right now in some significant programs, and I think that that's wrong. I think the challenge that we face is to say, okay, in America right now, we're looking at a growing gap between the rich, the very rich, and everybody else. We're seeing the middle class decline. We're seeing poverty increase, and yet we're seeing the people on top with incomes and wealth that have not existed in this country since the 1920s. The richest 1% own more wealth than the bottom 90%. The wealthiest 13,000 families earn more income than do the bottom 20 million families. Now, given that reality, given the fact that we have large deficits and a growing national debt, how do you address that issue? Well, I think it is, in fact, and my view may well be in a small minority here in the Senate, but I think it is appropriate to say that the very wealthiest people in this country who have been given huge tax breaks by President Bush and the Republican leadership to say, sorry, you can't maintain those huge tax breaks. And I think we have to look at restoring the tax bracket, for example, for the upper, very upper-income people back to over 39%. And if we do that, we can bring in another $97 billion over the next 4 years. And I think we have to take a hard look at repealing the capital gains and the dividends tax breaks. And if we do that, we can recapture something like $130 billion over the next 4 years. And there are other tax breaks given to the very wealthy that I think we have to take a look at.
Do you think the Democrats are going to have the courage to do that?
Is there are enormous unmet needs for working families in the middle class, which must be addressed. We have the highest rate of childhood poverty in the industrialized world. We have situations where middle-class families can't afford to send their kids to college. We have 47 million Americans who don't have any health insurance. We are treating our veterans absolutely shamefully. We have a major housing crisis. We should not be apologetic about saying these are issues that we have to address. But we have to address them in ways that do not raise deficits, that do not raise the national debt. And I think that means addressing the tax breaks, the corporate welfare, the wasteful military programs, weapon systems within the Pentagon. I think we have to have the courage to start raising this issue so that we can find the funding to address middle-class needs while at the same time lowering our national debt.
Now, I know that the reason that you can't be with us throughout this program is that you have to go off to a meeting with the Democratic caucus or the whatever it's called there. Do you think that the Democrats are going to have the political will and the courage, frankly, to take on Bush? I mean, he's pulling out all the stops. He essentially declared war yesterday with his op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal.
Well, what I think is that there are some Democrats who certainly are prepared to do that. There may be some Republicans who are prepared to do the right thing. But I think getting back to the original point that I made, that is why we need a massive grassroots effort. Because, you know, any politician looks around and says, look, if 90% of the people are in opposition to what I want to do, no, I'm not going to do it. You know, I'm up for re-election. But if we can rally the American people to say, look, if the choice is rescinding tax breaks literally to millionaires and billionaires who have never had it so good, so that we can fund higher education and make college education affordable to all Americans, so that we can fund child care, so that working mothers can have confidence knowing that when they leave their kids at child care, it's good quality, affordable child care, that we can keep the promises made to our veterans and only impact the wealthiest 1%. Do I think that most members of Congress are prepared to do that? Yeah, I do. But they're not going to do that unless there is strong support out there. And as you and I have talked about many issues many times, and I have to tell you some good news here, is I think there is increased discussion about this issue in Congress, is that we also need significant reforms in terms of the corporate control over the media. You and I, for example, have talked in the past a great deal about the estate tax. You remember that, Tom, many of those discussions that we've had?
I do, yeah.
And the Republican leadership wants to repeal the estate tax because it's ever so important for small business and family farmers. Well, that's all nonsense. What the Republicans wanted to do is give huge tax breaks for the wealthiest 0.2% of the American people. And it took us a long time having to combat the corporate media to get that word out.
Right.
So we all need to work together on making
to
these things happen.
Exactly. Bernie, we have to take a break. We're having an ISDN line problem here to reset during the commercial. Can you stick around?
Sure.
Okay, great. We'll be right back. 14 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the Tom Hartman Program, our Brunch with Bernie segment.
Wake up and shake it up. There is love from north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea. Our government gives a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully.
And welcome back to The Pillar. We'll help you escape the matrix. 21 minutes past the hour. We have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. Our question once again was, what mythological character may resemble a terrorist and be working in the United States illegally, according to Andy Borowitz? And congratulations to John Sullivan in Glendora, California. Hey, John. John, you know the correct answer is Santa Claus or Saint Nick. So, one of our fluffier progressive pop quizzes here, but what the heck. It's an interesting point. Milton Mayer, observed what happened in Germany after the war. He was an American. He was Jewish. He lived in Chicago. He was a writer, a reporter, a newspaper reporter. And after the war, he went over to Germany and spent quite a bit of time. As I recall, he spent a year or two there. It's been a few years since I read his book, They Thought They Were Free. And he got to know 10 Germans, just average Germans, and really got inside their heads and wrote down their stories, transcribed their stories. And here's what some of them said. One of them told him, what happened here in Germany was the gradual habituation of the people, little by little, to being governed by surprise, to receiving decisions deliberated in secret, to believing that the situation was so complicated that the government had to act on information which the people could not understand, or so dangerous that even if the people could understand it, it could not be released because of national security. Boy, that just, the president's, Bush's press conference this morning, here's another one. This separation of government from people, this widening of the gap, took place so gradually and so insensibly, each step disguised, perhaps not even intentionally, as a temporary emergency measure, or associated with true patriotic allegiance, or with real social purposes. And all the crises and reforms, and there were real reforms too, so occupied the people that they did not see the slow motion underneath of the whole process of government growing remoter and remoter. To live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me, unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness, acuity, than most of us ever had the occasion to develop. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained, or on some occasions regretted, that unless one were detached from the whole process from the beginning, unless one understood what the whole thing was in principle, what all these little measures were that no patriotic German could resent, what they must someday lead to, one no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing, although one day it is over his head. Another of his correspondents, the people that he was interviewing, said, Pastor Niemöller, you know, the guy who said first they came for the communists and then it ends up, you know, and then there was nobody left to come for me. Pastor Niemöller spoke for the thousands and thousands of men like me when he spoke too modestly of himself and said that when the Nazis attacked the communists, he was a little uneasy, but after all, he was not a communist, and so he did nothing. And then they attacked the socialists, he was a little uneasier, but still he was not a socialist, and he did nothing. And then the schools, the press, and the Jews, and so on. And he was always uneasier, but still he did nothing. And then they attacked the church, and he was a churchman, and he did something, but then it was too late. Yes, I said, this is Mayer interviewing him. You see, he went on, one doesn't see exactly where or how to move. Believe me, this is true. Each act, each occasion is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next and the next. You wait for the one great shocking occasion, thinking that others, when the shock comes, will join you in the streets in resisting somehow. You don't want to act or even to talk alone. You don't want to go out of your way to make trouble. Why not? Well, you're not in the habit of doing it. And it's not just fear of standing alone that restrains you. It is also genuine uncertainty. Uncertainty is a very important factor. And instead of decreasing as time goes on, it grows. Outside, in the streets, in the general community, everyone seems happy. One hears no protests, certainly sees none. You know, in France or Italy, there's slogans against the government painted on the walls and fences, but in Germany, outside the great cities, perhaps there's not even this. In the university community, in your own community, you speak privately to your colleagues, some of whom certainly feel as you do. But what do they say? They say, it's not so bad. You're seeing things. You're an alarmist. And you are an alarmist. You're saying that this must lead to that, and you can't prove it. These are the beginnings, yes, but how do you know for sure when you don't know the end? How do you know or even surmise the end? On the other hand, your enemies, the law, the regime, the party, they intimidate you. And on the other hand, your colleagues poo-poo you as pessimistic or even neurotic. But that one great shocking occasion where tens or hundreds of thousands will join you never comes.
So, welcome back. I am now live. What you were hearing over the last 4 or 5 minutes here was a pre-recorded segment because we're having a little bit of a problem connecting between the studio here in Pittsburgh and Air America headquarters in New York, which then feeds the signal to the satellite farm in Denver where it goes up on the satellite and then down and all that kind of stuff. Anyhow, it seems that we have the problem solved. In the meantime, Bernie had to boogie on out. Today is the first day that the Democrats are all getting together, the Democratic caucus or the Democratic meeting or whatever it is. So Bernie got a good rant in there in the beginning of the show. I'm back live with you. My apologies for 6 or 8 minutes there of an old rant, although it was a pretty good old rant. Our telephone number is 1-866-440-8466. A lot in the news today that I want to get through here. In particular, this whole thing of J. Michael McConnell, the guy who has been appointed this morning by Bush, I believe it has to be confirmed by the Senate, to be the new director of National Intelligence. And Michael McConnell, there is concern being expressed in a lot of corners and quarters, including in today's Wall Street Journal, interestingly enough, a concern being expressed that now with the appointment of this former admiral and former NSA director to the head, but most importantly a military man, as director of National Intelligence, now every major intelligence post in the United States is headed by a military person. And nobody is coming out and saying it quite in these terms. They're all couching it in this kind of diplomatic, we're a little concerned that the intelligence may be, blah, blah, blah. The actual phrase was, this is from today's Wall Street Journal, quoting Larry Johnson, with so many military guys involved, you run the risk of the intelligence agencies giving the consumers what they want to hear. What I'm seeing is essentially a slow-motion military coup. We're seeing the intelligence apparatus of the United States, which was designed to be in civilian hands, and which absolutely should be, in fact, I would say must be, in civilian hands, now being entirely taken over by military folks. Is this militarization of our intelligence apparatus, combined with the ongoing hyper-militarization of domestic police forces all across the United States, plus Bush asserting that he has the right to take control of the National Guard and all that sort of thing. Is there something bigger at play here? Or is this a setup for the invasion of Iran? I mean, is that what it's all about? We'll talk about that, and you take your calls right after the break. 27 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And, the big news of the day, as it were, J. Michael McConnell replacing Death Squad John Negroponte, as the director of National Intelligence. I think this is a bigger story than it's being given credit for, frankly. I think this is a really big deal. That now the entire intelligence apparatus of the United States, both the civilian intelligence apparatus, the CIA, the NSA, this Directorate of National Intelligence, plus, of course, the Pentagon, which actually controls about 80% of the total intelligence operations, that this is all now in military hands. And I am concerned. I am concerned that this might be part of a Bush program to prepare us, to have more cooked books to prepare us for more war. I mean, this is not a slam on the military, but what do military people do? They, their job is to blow up things and kill people, to fight wars, something that's absolutely necessary from time to time. But also civilian oversight of the military is absolutely necessary. In fact, I would say it's absolutely vital. It was in the minds of the founders. It's why the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Armed Forces is always a civilian. I mean, there was concern back when George Washington was elected president. We're putting a military guy here. And Eisenhower, some people raised some concerns about that. Do we really want a general leading the army? Yeah, same with Ulysses S. Grant. I mean, it's not that it hasn't happened before as president, but now here, the entire intelligence apparatus of the United States. So, a spooky one. And we seem to have resolved all of our technical problems. Kudos to Jason and Greg. Gary? Greg. Here at WPTT, and thanks to Ivy's mom from our chat room, Mary, who's driving me around today and hanging out with us. Mark in Grand Rapids on WTKG. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Yes, Tom, there's a problem that you can have with John Poindexter being linked to this new National Intelligence Director. I believe one of his civilian jobs is working with him in data mining. Now, I'm not for certain on that, but I would check that out because I would think that would be a real problem to have yet again another link to Iran-Contra in this Bush administration.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see, you know, if Mr. McConnell, how much scrutiny he gets. I mean, at least there's a Democratic Congress now, a Democratic Senate, that he's going to have to pass through in order to be confirmed. And as we know, Iran-Contra was never thoroughly investigated, in large part, I'd say, because Gerry Ford pardoned Nixon. There was just that mentality of, well, we just need to, you know, when there's scandals that involve the executive branch, we just need to put it behind us. And it hasn't served this country well. Amy Goodman wrote a great piece about this. You can see over at commondreams.org this morning that I think first appeared in the Seattle newspaper. Interesting point, Mark. Thank you for the call. Good to hear from you. Ken in Long Beach, California. Hey, Ken, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Oh, hi, Tom. Just a little follow-up from last week. I'm still flabbergasted by that good information you gave us out about the payout to the CEO, William McGuire. Say it. Go ahead.
$0.78 billion.
Yeah, I checked into it. You're spot on. I said it's called Business Week Online, talked about it, October 06. And I read the article, and it turns out under hard times for UnitedHealth that the guy even lost money. The stock went down from 65 down to the mid-40s. And this guy is still – I don't understand. What's that? Hello?
Tommy there?
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 43 minutes past the hour. And we're getting all this figured out here, all this technical stuff, the wonders of doing remote radio. I remember back years and years ago, back in the 1970s, I used to do remotes, and we used to have to do them with FM radios, you know, from the radio station to the wherever you were, you know, the dance or the mall or whatever it was. And, yeah, a bunch of old radio people here going, yeah, I remember those days. So, anyhow, it's kind of the same thing. Steve in San Francisco, listening on the Quake. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. You know, it's always wonderful to hear you, the intelligence, and then the intelligence of the callers. Speaking of which, this morning on Air America, an old guy called in and said, you know, maybe the Joint Chiefs should have a meeting at a vote of no confidence in George leading them due to his inability to think like a military man.
Or his inability to think like a president.
And I thought that was a fabulous idea.
Yeah, well, in principle it would be, Steve. The reality is that the Joint Chiefs are never going to do that because they serve at the pleasure of Bush. That would be like all the vice presidents of a big corporation getting together and saying, we're going to have a vote of no confidence for the CEO. And in fact, it's the board of directors that appoints that CEO, and those vice presidents have to do what the CEO says. And the board of directors here in the United States is we the people and is Congress. And so the vote of no confidence for George Bush should not be coming from the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That would be something close to a military coup. It would actually be a very bad and dangerous thing, in my opinion. The vote of no confidence should be coming from Congress. It should be coming
from the House. The vote of no confidence just came in the last election.
Yeah, it, the beginning. But I think the big point that Bernie was making in the first segment of the show, and he made the point a couple of times, but I suspect that he made it subtly enough that not everybody got it, is that it's not enough that we have a bunch of Democrats running the House and Senate. It is still going to take you and me. It's got to be we, the people, getting out there and getting engaged and getting involved and holding the Democrats in Congress accountable. Otherwise, they're just going to wimp out. You know, they're going to take the easiest course, and the easiest course is not to have, you know, fights with the Republicans. The Republicans are going to be promising, you know, on the outside, they're going to be talking about, oh, it's all nice and good, and we'll make everything fine. But on the inside, you know, in the back rooms, the Republicans are going to be saying, you know, cross us, and we're going to draw blood. And the Democrats, if they're going to have the courage to take on that kind of bully activity that historically we've seen from the Republicans, at least these modern Republicans, they're going to have our support. If we don't, you know, you there in San Francisco, Nancy Pelosi represents you, should be calling her office and saying, I want you to be as hard as possible with this guy. Let's hold them accountable. Let's have investigations. Let's look into this. You know, all these things. And by the way, we don't want a war with Iran in March like it looks like Bush is getting ready for. So,
but I always tell everybody that I talk to, if they can knock Dan Rather out of his position, it's no wonder everybody's afraid. You know, it's you, it's your own family. They can knock you out, and your children are the ones homeless. That's why people.
Oh, I know. The Reich in this country, the Reich wing in this country, has mind-boggling power. And in fact, in the next hour of the program, we're going to be interviewing a conservative judge who has a book out about how the liberals are taking over the world. And you get a sense of that worldview. And by the way, in the third hour of our program, we're going to be back to writing our book, Cracking the Code. And I'm going to be talking about chunking and framing, which I'll be doing with this judge in the second hour. It should be interesting. But the bottom line here, Steve, is that it has to be us. We have to get involved. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. John in Gilbert, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, John.
Hey, Tom, like I always say to you, you're an inspiration to me and to we the people, and I also take your three-hour course as my time to be in class.
Well, thank you.
I learned a lot from you. Tom, I was wondering if you could help educate me and help me understand, now since Dems are in charge of the House and the Senate, how does Criminal Bush still get away with warrantless mail opening now, and he still wants to send more troops to Iraq when the study group clearly states we shouldn't do that?
Sure. Well, first of all, the study group doesn't have any authority or power, and you know this was the last-ditch effort by Bush Sr., by Poppy, to try to salvage his family's reputation and you know the Bush dynasty and legacy, and it ain't working. But with regard to Bush's signing statement yesterday or the day before yesterday on this piece of legislation for reauthorizing and reforming the Postal Service, I don't know. And I've been watching. In fact, it was one of the things that I wanted to ask Bernie about. It's a shame he had to run off or rush off. How can Congress take on the whole issue of signing statements? I suspect that this is something that the Supreme Court is going to have to deal with. But I just don't know. And it concerns me tremendously because you have Bush saying, you have a law that was passed by Congress, and the Constitution clearly says Congress makes the laws, the President enforces the laws. The President controls the apparatus like, you know, the FBI, the police apparatus of the country, the Department of Justice, the military. He controls the apparatus by which the laws of the United States are enforced, but he does not make the laws. He is responsible to uphold the Constitution and enforce the laws. Congress makes the laws. And when Bush makes a signing statement, and by the way, this isn't something that started with him, it started with Reagan, but when Bush puts a signing statement, but what Bush has done, and even Bill Clinton did some signing statements, but by and large, they were, this is a fine piece of legislation, I agree with it, and therefore I'm signing it. They were more perfunctory. But Bush has been issuing signing statements that actually contradict the legislation itself, that say, the executive branch is going to ignore this piece of legislation or provisions of this piece of legislation. And I don't think that the Congress, he has already defied the Congress in that context. And my hope is somebody will take this to the Supreme Court. And then my concern is that he's been stacking the Supreme Court with right-wing ideologues like John Roberts and Sam Alito who are going to kowtow to him and do what he wants. I mean, this is not a good thing. It's not a good thing, and we'll have to see how it plays out. But, John, I don't have an easy answer for that one. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just curious. I just really hope the Dems are just really hard on him. And the day I open up the newspaper and see him behind bars, it would be victory for me.
Well, again, the only way that the Democrats are going to be tough on the Bush administration is if you and I hold them to account. And we have to do that. We all have to become activists. It's not enough just to vote. And the election being over doesn't mean that it's time to sit back or that we should just be sitting around speculating about who's going to be the best candidate for president 2.5 years from now.
We need to.
Tom, I love your show. I do everything I can on my side, and I try to tell everybody that they got to listen to Tom Hartman.
Thanks a lot, John. And thanks for listening to KPHX. Ken in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG. Hey, Ken, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I love your show. I've been listening to you for 2 years religiously. Three, 4 days ago, you started on this Gerald R. Ford's going to be the reason why we can't impeach George Bush or investigate George Bush, and I don't agree with that. I think, you know, we had no problem investigating Bill Clinton for a financial dealings and personal indiscretions, and we impeached him over a lie. I think what Bush has done has been so much, you know, a greater crime that we'd have no problem. I think the pressure of the people, the fact that we've got a Democratic Senate and a Democratic-run Congress right now, that if they investigate Bush, that there will have no problems going forward with proceedings as long as they come up with the evidence that he lied and that he got us into a war on according to those lies.
Yeah, it's getting the evidence. Well, you make a good point that Clinton was in fact impeached, and they did do the investigations of Clinton, and they, you know, you had all these guys out there bloviating about it, and nobody was saying, oh, you know, we need to heal the country, you know, quack quack quack. Let's not do it. It seems like there's a double standard here, Ken. When a Republican gets in trouble, like Reagan with Iran-Contra, I mean, he said,
right,
I don't remember what, 138 times, as I recall. When a Republican gets in trouble, well, you know, let's just let it pass for the best of the country. And when they investigated Iran-Contra, they specifically put into the authorizing legislation for the investigations that they couldn't look at what was going on prior to the election. You know, was this part of a Republican dirty trick? Can't even look at that. It's never been investigated by Congress.
Right.
And so, you know, when Republicans get in trouble or when Republicans break the law, there's no investigation. When a Democrat breaks the law, holy cow, he lied before a grand jury. He was having sex with this woman in the White House. We can't have this. You know, and this being done by the way, people like Bob Barr and Newt Gingrich, who at the very time they were yelling and screaming, and Ken Livingston, who at the very time they were yelling and screaming about Clinton having sex in the White House, were having sex with their own aides.
Yeah, but don't you think that in the Reagan situation, though, I mean, maybe the insiders knew what we didn't know, that didn't come out for about a year or so, that he was having problems with Alzheimer's. I remember they wanted to revamp the Constitution so he could run a third time. They dropped it, I believe, because they realized the man was having problems with Alzheimer's. And so when he goes before the Congress, the hearings, and he says, I don't remember, maybe they knew something that wasn't out in the public yet.
Well, it was an open secret. You know, the last 3 years of the Reagan presidency, that there was nobody home. In fact, it was an open secret in the second year, the third year of his first term, that there was something seriously wrong. Everybody just assumed it was old age dementia.
Well, where did he have the meeting with Gorbachev, where, you know, he just had his hat handed to him, you know?
Well, not only that, he had that meeting with Gorbachev, and he was telling him that he served in World War II.
You were there in the 60s and early 70s.
Yeah.
I was there. Gerald Ford was the first person I was old enough to vote for, and I've been a lifelong Democrat, liberal. But, you know, I believe that Gerald Ford at that time, and I did like the fact that he pardoned Nixon, and he said some things that I didn't agree with, but I really did believe the man was an honest man. Even though he was a conservative or he was Republican, he cared about the people, and I thought it was a time that we needed honesty in the White House.
I agree with that,
Ken. 12 years of, you know, assassinations and civil rights, riots in the streets and a war that tore us apart. Don't you think at that time we really did need to step back, take a breath, and get ourselves together?
I think at that time, at that point in time, I think we needed a national healing and a national reconciliation, yes. And Jerry Ford, simply by his personality, by being a fundamentally decent guy, and I really believe he was, and I've said that on the air here many times, I think that he provided us with a lot of that. And I believe that if Jerry Ford had allowed an ongoing prosecution of Richard Nixon to happen, that would have healed America, because it would have sent the message that we do respect the rule of law here in the United States.
You don't think the fact that we didn't trust our government back then, and we didn't trust our government back then, that we needed to have an honest man and needed to get over? I mean,
I think the way you restore trust in government is by prosecuting those people who have done wrong in government. Richard Nixon got away with what, I mean, it might even literally be he got away with murder. I mean, arguably, well, certainly in Vietnam he got away with murder. He ran on the platform twice that he was going to end the Vietnam War immediately. He had a secret plan to do it. It turns out he was lying to us. But with regard to Watergate, you know, he got away with a major crime. And I don't think that's a national healing message to send to people, that you can get away with a major crime just because you happen to be president of the United States. And I think that had Nixon been prosecuted, I don't think it would have wounded the United States. I think it would have healed the United States. I don't think it would have shut down the government, because it would have happened outside of the government. He was already out of office. He had already resigned. And I think that it would be far less likely that Bush and Reagan would have committed the crimes that they did, Bush Sr. and Reagan, during the Bush-Reagan administration, specifically around Contra. And I think it's far less likely that George W. Bush would have invaded Iraq by lying to us.
You don't think at that time, during the Cold War and everything, it was a good thing for other countries around us that were involved in the Cold War to see that we were stabilized, that we had a...
No. Because when you say just because the guy's the leader of the country, we're going to let him get away with a crime, that's not the kind of message you want to send to anybody. No, Ken. I acknowledge with you Jerry Ford's goodness and decency at a fundamental level, and I think it was a horrible mistake to have pardoned Nixon, and I'm standing by that. Thanks for the call, Ken. Good to hear from you, and thanks for listening to us there on Clear Channel in Grand Rapids. 57 minutes past the hour. Andy Borowitz reports, God denies talking to Pat Robertson. Yeah, we'll see how that all shakes out. Tom Hartman here with you, back right after the news at the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live today from our Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania affiliate, WPTT AM 1360, I believe it is. And welcome back to the program. We have with us Judge Robert H. Durker, Jr., he's a sitting judge, and the author of a new book, The Tyranny of Tolerance. A sitting judge breaks the code of silence to expose the liberal judicial assault. Judge Durker, welcome to the program.
Thank you, and call me Bob.
Okay, great. Am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
You are.
Great, okay. In your book, you start out the opening chapter, the cloud cuckoo land of radical feminism, and you talk about how the Supreme Court in the past, in fact, you're quoting Justice Bradley in 1882, you say the gravamen of the decision was simply that the judgment about who was suited to be lawyer should be made by the legislature, and that's a case that's actually referring to presumably the Bradwell versus Illinois case of 1873.
Right.
You suggest that the court was even back then saying that women and men should relatively be equally treated, and that now they're not. Do I have this right?
I think you're pretty close. The thrust of the argument from my perspective is that what the Supreme Court did back then was to leave the policy decision to the legislature, and they did not attempt to write into the Equal Protection Clause a judgment that could not be overturned except by constitutional amendment. So, you know, I don't think the Supreme Court, Justice Bradley had his views, which I think you could justly say were putting his personal views into the law, but the decision itself did not freeze the status quo. It simply said, let's let the elected officials decide this question.
Well, and you talk about femifascists now?
Well, I use that term to describe people who hold a particular philosophy. It's not directed at women as such, because, as I think we both know, you know, there are conservative women, liberal women, independent women. This is a philosophy that I think is embraced by certain people, which I use the term because I feel that the philosophy is one that does not tolerate dissent, does not tolerate disagreement. does not tolerate debate about whether there should be any differences made by the law between men and women.
Well, but, you know, to quote Justice Bradley back in Bradwell versus Illinois, I mean, this is from the actual case. This is the actual decision, right? Justice Bradley says, the harmony, not to say the identity of interests and views which belong or should belong to the family institution, is repugnant to the idea of a woman adopting a distinct and independent career from that of her husband. So firmly fixed was this sentiment in the founders of the common law that it became a maxim of our system of jurisprudence that a woman has no legal existence separate from her husband, who is regarded as her head and representative in the social state. And then two sentences later, he says, he goes on to say, the paramount destiny and mission of women are to fulfill the noble and benign offices of mother and wife. This is the law of the Creator, and the rules of civil society must be adapted to the general constitution of things and cannot be based upon exceptional cases. Are you in agreement with that?
No. No, I think he's a, in my judgment, he was a precursor of some of the judges that I disagree with currently.
But you're praising him in your book.
I beg your pardon?
You're praising him in your book. I'm looking at your page 20.
I respectfully disagree. My point, I'm not praising him. Indeed, indirectly, I'm rejecting his approach. The decision, what I want to get away from is, you know, his concurring opinion was the kind of thing that I think is happening now on the other side of the coin. And it's the kind of thing that should not happen either way. And, you know, his opinion was not the majority opinion. And I quote Justice Frankfurter, who wrote in the 40s when there was a law forbidding women to be bartenders. And his quote is in the book, which I'm paraphrasing it. I don't have it memorized. But the bottom line of his quote was that even, you know, the legislature is not bound by the contemporary sociology, and we as a court are not going to substitute our judgment for that of the legislature on a debatable point.
But isn't the legislature and the court actually, in fact, bound by the contemporary sociology? I mean, there was a time in this country when the contemporary sociology was that slavery was a good thing.
Well,
times change.
Well,
we had, you know, laws against interracial marriage right up until the 1950s in the United States.
Exactly, and I think all of those situations, as I discuss in the book, in the chapter where I outline what I see as the evolution of the Equal Protection Clause away from what it was intended to be, the cases that you're mentioning exemplify the philosophy of ignoring the meaning and the plain intent of the Constitution. And so you got the anti-miscegenation laws, which on their face were unconstitutional, because the whole point of the 14th Amendment was we're not making distinctions based on race. And yet now we have Justice Ginsburg talking about benign discrimination. You know, that's the problem as I see it. I think, you know, I think Plessy versus...
So Ferguson, you don't think that there is a time when it's appropriate to right wrongs?
I think there is, but I think the critical question is, within whose power is it to right this wrong? In any given case, every judge, I think, tries to achieve a fair and just result in any given case.
In a case that you talk about in your book, in 1998, you say, in 1998, a case came before me about a woman who alleged that a male defendant had harassed her. And you basically, I don't want to put words in your mouth. You can correct my read of your book here, however you'd like. But basically, it seems like you said, you know, she wasn't raped, she wasn't fired, he wasn't threatening her with her job, and therefore this wasn't sexual harassment. Is that the fact that he was touching her, even though it wasn't sexual, and that he was making all kinds of sexual references to her, and he was her supervisor, all of that stuff doesn't constitute sexual harassment in your mind?
Well, the issue that I had in front of me was whether that notion that had been formulated in employment discrimination cases was going to be imported into the common law. And what I was focusing on, or attempting to focus on, was the great danger of the courts imposing liability based on words alone. And I felt it was an issue that had been ignored in the employment discrimination context, with the result that we've had a proliferation of speech codes in the workplace that are backed by the implied threat of judicial enforcement.
But there's all kinds of laws that about liability based on words alone. I mean, slander and libel come to mind immediately.
Yes, but the First Amendment, and I think you and I would agree, the First Amendment recognizes very few exceptions. Defamation, the so-called fighting words, You have very few situations where words alone, obscenity, very few situations where words alone can import any kind of legal or criminal liability.
You suggest in your book, and this is a quote, no court has ever held that a sexual had ever held a sexual advance to be actionable in and of itself.
Correct.
If somebody who was your supervisor, your boss, came to you, let's say it's a man, and came to you and sexually propositioned you, and you would have no problem with that.
Well, I might have a problem with it, but
you don't think that you should have a legal remedy about that.
I might have a problem with it at the personal level, but what I'm trying to get across is the issue of whether the judicial power is going to be deployed to impose some kind of liability, and with the
but we have laws on the books about this.
Well,
I mean, there are laws against sexual harassment. Why should courts not enforce those laws?
Well, this is, I keep going back to the basic premise that when you start censoring speech, no matter where you're doing that, then you're striking at the core value of the First Amendment. And the Title VII, the evolution of the workplace harassment law has operated pretty much ignoring the implications of the First Amendment.
But this goes beyond speech. This goes right to the heart of the power relationship between an employer and an employee.
Well, you know, once again,
and you think again, government should have no role in that.
When you start to get into imposing liability, if you're dealing with words alone, you run the risk of doing what happened in a California case I mentioned in the book, where the judge imposed a speech code. He defined what words could not be used in the workplace. Now, I don't think anybody would have objected, or to state it another way, I don't think anybody would have supported or encouraged the use of abusive words or in the workplace. But
well, implicitly
premise,
you are.
I beg your pardon?
I said implicitly you are. But
what I'm attempting to discourage is censorship by the judiciary. And, you know, I think you have to look at what, you know,
you
what
the
value needs to be preserved. The value that's in the Constitution, or that says that because the effect on the listener is not the litmus test, you have to look at the exceptions to the First Amendment. And that's the thrust of my argument.
We're talking with, can you stick around for a minute?
I'll be happy to.
I'd like to get into the Endangered Species Act with you. We're talking with Judge Robert Dierker, Jr. He is the author of a new book, Tyranny of Tolerance. The Tyranny of Tolerance, a sitting judge breaks the code of silence to expose the liberal judicial assault. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harper. Shake it up. Shake it up. Shake it up. Shake it up. And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting live today from our affiliate in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WPTT. I'll be signing books tonight at the Borders out in Monroeville, Pennsylvania. We have with us on the line Judge Robert Dierker, Jr. He's the author of The Tyranny of Tolerance, a sitting judge breaks the code of silence to expose the liberal judicial assault. And Judge Dierker, you say in your book, in Life, Liberty, but Not Property, by now, everybody should know the travesty called the Endangered Species Act, another Nixon legacy born of his desire to buy off the liberals in one area in the hope they'd leave him alone in the other areas. Worked like a charm, didn't it? The Endangered Species Act is another example of the liberal method of using the judiciary to advance policies agreeable to liberals without letting little things like the Constitution or established principles of statutory construction get in the way. I'm confused. You're calling the Endangered Species Act, which is a piece of law put together by the legislature, an example of the courts, the liberal method at that, advancing policies agreeable to liberals. What am I missing here?
I think what you're missing is the text of the Constitution, which protects property as well as life and liberty.
Well, the text of the Constitution also gives Congress the right to pass laws.
It certainly does, but I think the one premise which I accept and I think is essential to the constitutional order is that the judiciary does indeed have the right and duty to say what the law is and to declare a statute unconstitutional. And so my point is, in the context of the Endangered Species Act, you have a gentleman in Michigan, I think, who was hauled into court threatened with, imposed huge fines on him for
this
filling.
This is the bat. No, this is not the bat.
The name is escaping me at the moment, but it was Rapanos, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Was handed down last term, and it was a 5-4 decision. But you know, the man had a few wet spots on his land, which he went ahead and filled in without the permission of the Army Corps of Engineers. The Constitution, the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment, both speak about life, liberty, and property. And my point is that the courts, because if it's a matter where the liberal philosophy approves of the objective, then the courts ignore the text of the Constitution.
It seems to me, sir, that in decrying judicial activism, you are its leading proponent. You're suggesting that if the duly elected legislature, I mean, this is the basis of our Constitution, is that we collectively as a society are going to elect people who represent us, who represent our will, who represent society's consensus at the moment, whatever that may be, and they're going to pass laws, and those are going to be the law of the land. And they passed a law saying it's illegal to harass women in the workplace, and you say, no, judges shouldn't enforce that. And the legislature, passed a law saying that we want to protect endangered species, and you say, no, we shouldn't, you know, judges shouldn't enforce that. This is extreme judicial activism on the conservative end that you're advocating, not examples of liberal judicial activism.
I understand your point, and I guess you would then accept the proposition that abortion can be regulated by an act of Congress.
If Congress decides so. I mean,
it is done in the partial birth abortion statute, which is currently pending in the Supreme Court. You know, I think my point is that you have to look at how the judicial power is being exercised and whether it has any root in the text and tradition of the Constitution. And property is explicitly guaranteed in the Constitution, as is the freedom of speech.
Well, you know, Jefferson did not take Locke literally, life, liberty, and the right to private property. That was John Locke. Thomas Jefferson said life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Well, the
Fifth Amendment...
The Declaration of Independence uses pursuit of happiness, but the 14th and 15th, the 5th and 14th Amendments, which are the text of the Constitution itself, which is the operative law, refer to property. And
the
I think
Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, though, says merely, in referring to property, merely says that if we the people collectively decide that we're going to appropriate somebody's property, they have to be appropriately compensated.
Well,
and that it has to be for the public good.
You're looking at the Just Compensation Clause. The Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment both say no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law.
Right, and due process of law is the legislature passes a law, the judges, the judiciary says, yes, this is what they said, and what you're calling for, and again, you know, your Judge Moore kind of thing about isn't it horrible that they had to take the Ten Commandments out of the court. What you're calling for is for judges to ignore the law because you disagree with it, because you think it's too liberal.
I think that the premise is not because what the policy objective is. The premise is what does the text of the Constitution say?
But it can be interpreted a thousand different ways.
Well,
I mean, the Constitution is 230 years old. We have interpreted the Constitution as a whole, you know, saying.
You state the opposite view very well, but I think it's an invalid position. I think that the Constitution has a meaning, and in many cases it has a very explicit meaning, which can be and has been interpreted out. The Just Compensation Clause that you alluded to, the way that was construed, the further and further, you know.
Well, I think we both disagree on Kelo, for example, but.
Well, I'm sorry. I thought you would defend the right of the citizen not to have property expropriated for some.
No, because the Fifth Amendment says for the public good, and I, you know, one quick question.
Public use. It says for public
use. Yeah, you're right.
That's
which is not private use. I'm just curious. We have to wrap up in like 10 seconds. Quick thought on signing statements. In your opinion, is this legal what Bush is doing?
I think the president, like any of us, can say anything he wants about how he's going to interpret the statute. And then, ultimately, the judges do say what the law is.
Yeah, and that's where it's going to end up. Okay, Judge Bob Dirker, Jr., The Tyranny of Tolerance, his book. Thanks for being with us today, sir.
Well, thank you for being liberal enough to hear me.
You're welcome. 27 minutes past the hour.
Thunder on the mountain and as far as the moon. The ruckus in the alley and the summer of the sea. Today's the day, gonna grab my trombone and blue. Well, it's hot stuff here, and it's everywhere I go.
And welcome back to the radio home of democracy. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Yeah, it is getting warm all over the place. Here I am in Pittsburgh in January, and I'm looking out at rain. I don't see any snow anywhere. Last time I was in Pennsylvania was, I think, 2 years ago. And you have snow in the winter here. You're supposed to have snow. What happened? We don't know. Global warming, I would say. Anyhow, I'll be at tonight in Monroeville at the Borders at 7 o'clock signing books and doing a rant. And then tomorrow at 2 o'clock in Minneapolis, a lecture and book signing at the Lindale United Church of Christ, 31st Street and Aldrich Avenue South in Minneapolis. That's sponsored by the bookstore Magers and Quinn. And that'll be at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Kristen in Castor Valley. Is it Castor Valley, California?
Yes.
Hey, Kristen.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I was listening to you talk to the judge who wrote that horrific book, the anti-tolerance book.
Yes.
And you were talking about the case of sexual harassment.
Yes.
Where the woman was suing the boss, and the judge kept saying he didn't think the boss should have any liability based on speech alone because of the First Amendment,
right.
Which sort of makes sense. However, when you first brought up the case, you said that the boss was also touching the woman.
Yes.
And I didn't hear you question the judge about that, because he totally overlooked the fact that touching without consent is, in my opinion, assault.
Yeah, arguably it is, but the touching was not sexual, and that wasn't the basis actually of her complaint. That was sort of added to it. The main basis of her complaint was what he said, and basically what he was saying was that he wanted to have sex with her, and she was a subordinate of his. And I think the point that I made, that this is where the judge and I disagree, and I think fundamentally it's where conservatives and liberals disagree, is that when you have power relationships, that one of the purposes of civil society, one of the purposes of law, is to give some balance to power relationships so that people who are powerless are not utterly powerless, that they have some recourse or some remediation. The fact of the matter is, in the United States, we do have to work in order to survive, as it were. You know, you have to have a job in order to have health insurance, for example, by and large. You have to have a job in order to pay for your home and your car and put your kids through school and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And if your job is at risk because you're unwilling to engage in sexual behavior with somebody, non-consensually, then that should be considered a violation of the law. And the legislators got together, our elected officials, and said, it is a violation of the law. And so this judge comes along and says, no, it's not a violation of the law. Forget what the legislature said, because the Constitution says everybody has freedom of speech, and that guy was just saying, hey, you know, let's get it on, or whatever he was saying. And I just, you know, I mean, I'm not going to, you know, scream at the guy that he's, you know, a nutcase or something, but I just strongly disagree with that. I think there is a time and place to balance those power relationships between employer and employee, and at a certain level between men and women as well.
Well, that's what I was concerned about, and sometimes I get nervous when I hear two men talking about, you know, women's rights, because I look at it even from a different angle. In the power relationship, what you have is usually the woman is going to be smaller and weaker than the man. I mean, even if he's the boss, you also have the additional power dynamic of vulnerability physically.
Yes.
And if he was touching her, then she might, I don't know if she brought this up in her case, but what I thought is she probably was scared physically. And even if the touching was not sexual, it was probably domineering and threatening,
yeah.
I would imagine.
And I can say, as a man, I have known men who do that, and I've been the recipient of it. I mean, I've in situations where it wasn't an employer, it was a vendor, it was a customer, somebody that I wanted to do business with, and this guy is constantly, you know, grabbing my arm and slapping me on the back and doing it in hard, in ways that are, you know, that seem to be friendly but really are establishing dominance.
Right.
And I know how uncomfortable I felt. It's been many years since that happened, but I remember it very clearly, and I know how uncomfortable I felt with it. If there was the added possibility that that man might have in his mind having sex with me, that would make it even more uncomfortable. And if added to that was the fact that it wasn't just a customer, you know, the head of a company who I was trying to get to hire my ad agency, but instead it was my boss, you know, the person who has the ability to fire me, the person who has the ability to pull my health insurance. I mean, you know, it's just I just strongly disagree with the conservative position that people should be allowed to say anything in the workplace, and that's constitutionally protected speech. Sexual harassment is constitutionally protected speech. And I disagree with this characterization of women who take the position that I just took as femifascists. He calls them, his whole chapter, he calls them femi-fascists. Women,
oh,
he's
my
God. Yeah, I know. So but, you know, the reason I wanted to have him on was that he represents a worldview that is not, I mean, we could describe it as lunatic fringe, but there's a lot of people in the conservative movement who subscribe to that worldview. And I just, you know, I think it's important to out that and to also have the debate about it. Got to run along. Kristen, thanks so much for calling.
Okay.
And for listening to us there on the Quake. I appreciate it. Mike in Squirrel Hill, Pennsylvania. Hey, right here right here where I am.
Tom, I'm a first-time listener and a first-time caller. I think you're doing a fine job. I want to thank you for taking my call. You know, the first point I want to make, and you've probably alluded to this before, your listeners need to know, this guy is not a judge because he was the best lawyer available. In America, both at the state level, typically, and certainly at the federal level, you become a judge because of who you know.
Well,
not
he's actually an elected judge.
Well, typically, it's not because he's the best lawyer. And when he says to your listeners, there's not a reported case out there where liability has been imposed simply because of what was said, he's dead bang wrong.
Yeah, and I pointed that out to him.
I practiced law in California for 20 years. I defended employers that were public agencies, that were cities, counties, school districts, special districts. And if a judge ruled that, he would be reversed on appeal in no time straight. I could cite you cases, because here's the way sexual harassment works. It's either based on common law or statute. And in California, you can bring a common law or a statutory claim. In the federal courts, it's Title VII. You have two types of claims. Quid pro quo, which is, if you don't sleep with me, you won't get that job, you won't get that promotion, you won't get that raise. Or hostile work environment. And hostile work environment involves comments. It involves cartoons. It involves the kind of actions that he was alluding to.
Right. In fact, in some cases, even the posting of sexually suggestive calendars has been held to be
cartoons. Firefighters with Playboy in the firehouse.
Right. Yeah.
But here's another thing that's important, and this is both based on U.S. Supreme Court precedent and, in the case of California, state Supreme Court precedent. Sexual harassment is a strict liability offense. And what I mean by that is, as a claimant, and you can be a man or a woman, as a claimant, you don't have to have damages. You don't have to say, I lost my job because I didn't submit. I didn't get that raise. I have thousands of dollars in psychiatrist bills. The U.S. Supreme Court has said, you don't have to show that. So if you don't have to show damages, and we know from hostile work environment it can include just offensive language, this guy is wrong. And I can tell you, there is a reported case in California where the employee wasn't even fired. It was called, it wasn't wrongful termination based on harassment. It was simply wrongful harassment in the workplace.
No, and that's part of a whole spectrum of law that essentially says that there are certain things that you don't step over. If you put a gun in somebody's face, whether you pull the trigger or not, they may not suffer any harm at all, but that can still be considered assault. Yes, absolutely. Good point, Mike. Thank you very much.
And a great show. You're doing a great job for your audience. I plan to tune in more in the future.
Great. Thanks. And thank you for listening to WPTT. Jessica in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jessica.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. I'm great. What's up?
Well, I listened to that judge, and I found him, he seems to, I don't agree with anything he said, but he seems to be a pretty strict constitutionalist. Like, no interpretation, you know.
But see, that in and of itself is an interpretation. That's
yeah.
my problem. That's my problem.
Well, exactly. And I was listening to him talk about the Endangered Species Act, and I was I pulled out my little copy of the U.S. Constitution I keep in my bag with me at all times. And he doesn't seem to understand that with the Endangered Species Act, in that requires protection of environmental, you know, places and stuff. And when you destroy the environment, you are going against our pursuit of life and happiness. I mean, our
sure.
lives is based
and the
on
general welfare.
Having a clean environment.
Yeah, and you're harming the general welfare, which is
exactly.
One of the six items in the preamble of the Constitution.
Exactly, and it says right there in the Declaration of Independence that we have the right, to powers of form, yeah, that we can
life,
change
liberty,
it, make the rules
purpose.
Different.
Yeah.
The people, they can alter or abolish it.
Right. I mean, this is so weird that these guys call themselves conservatives and say that they are interpreting the Constitution in its meaning when the founders and framers were strong advocates of the passage of laws to protect the commons.
Exactly.
There's no end of examples. Jessica, thank you for the call. Well, what can I say? It's self-evident. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you in the real free speech zone. We'll be right back.
With majority power, now you are able to put the checks and balances back on the table. W and Cheney, they both got it coming. Smoke them out. Get 'em running.
Sounds like a plan.
Go get 'em.
Yeah, go get 'em, Democrats.
Girl,
go get 'em. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Listener supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. Listen to the sponsors on your local stations and patronize them, please, as well as our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com, and the Organic Wine Company, Eco Wine. 1-866-440-8466. Yesterday we talked about the signing statement that Bush had attached to the postal renewal, Jeff. What was the official name of that piece of legislation?
It was the postal reform bill.
Reform.
I don't know the exact name.
Yeah, okay. And Bush attaches a signing statement to it that even though the bill says first class mail is sacrosanct, Bush says, no, I can read anybody's mail I want to, and I don't even have to ask a judge. And apparently, if Lauren is correct, you are familiar with or know about a website for postal workers who are upset about this?
Yeah, actually, I don't know if everybody remembers the Patriot Act. The librarians kind of rose up and fought back on that provision.
Yeah, in large part, and, by the way, because Bernie Sanders got them going.
That's awesome. You know, well, I just went. I got so upset yesterday. I went home last night and spent all night working on the computer to build this website and to get a petition going. Mm-hmm. And so I just want any postal workers that listen to the show or family members to please check out the website, sign the petition, and go to your unions and tell them about this effort.
Cool. What's the website?
It's postalworkersunited.blogspot.com.
Okay. Postalworkersunited.blogspot.com. Check it out. And you don't need to be a postal worker to go there and support the postal worker.
No, right? No. Please come comment, send emails, hook me up with any postal workers you know. Help in this effort because for some reason people a lot of times aren't willing to attack the government or the president on their own. And so it's nice when we can get together in small groups or medium-sized groups, whatever.
And in my opinion, in addition to going to postalworkersunited.blogspot.com, people also need to be calling their legislators, their member
absolutely.
Of the House of Representatives and both of their senators, and saying, this should not stand. This must not stand.
Can I jump in on that? I called my representatives yesterday, and normally the staff doesn't know what the heck I'm talking about.
Sure.
But today, the story broke in the morning, and yet the staff of these representatives knew all about it, and they agreed with me.
That's great.
That it's wrong, and we have to do something about it. So
that's
good.
Great.
That's very positive.
That's great. Well, yeah, good. And good on you for calling with Jeff, and good on you for putting together the postalworkersunited.blogspot.com website. And hopefully some of our listeners will get over there and help you out. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks a lot.
Terrence in Pittsburgh, California.
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Terrence. Is that really Pittsburgh, California?
Yeah, Pittsburgh, California. Not as big as Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
What a hoot, because I'm sitting here in a radio studio in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania right now.
No, Pittsburgh's a little town about 45 miles east of San Francisco out on the river.
Oh, okay, great, great. I, for a minute there, I thought Lauren must have typed it in wrong, but she's usually really good about these kind of things. And so, well, anyhow, that's not what you called about. You called about our harassment case here.
Well, I called because my wife was listening to you this morning, and there was a case that apparently everybody was looking for the name of and couldn't come up with it, so she called me up. And I think the case you're looking for is... Ellison versus Brady.
And that case was what?
That was a case that established the reasonable woman standard in Title VII sexual harassment cases.
Oh, interesting. A federal case.
Federal case.
Yeah, so that would be the one that the judge, we had Judge Robert Durker on. He's on the 22nd Judicial Circuit of Missouri, a sitting judge, and he's written this book called The Tyranny of Tolerance. A sitting judge breaks the code of silence to expose the liberal judicial assault. And he suggests that that case is part of a femifascist conspiracy in America by liberals to subvert the Constitution.
Well, it's interesting that because the reasonable woman standard that was established in that case was based on the radical premise that men and women view the world differently, and that there are some things that a man would not be bothered by that a woman certainly would be bothered by.
Hmm.
And it's not a... I know that it's been trashed in certain circles as, oh my God, this is this puts us all at the mercy of the hypersensitive woman, that if somebody looks at somebody sideways, then we're going to freak out and all be sued. But that's not what it's about at all. It's
right.
Not talking about the hypersensitive woman. It's talking about the reasonable woman.
So this is for sexual harassment, the equivalent of the reasonable man theory, which it goes back in common law to back to British common law. You know, every case ultimately is adjudicated based on, you know, what would a reasonable person do under these circumstances.
Correct. And the issue that came up in the Ellison case was, it was a examination of whether you can use the reasonable man or even the reasonable person standard in a sexual harassment case, whether that made sense considering the nature of the case. And the bottom, sort of the subject of the case, was the plaintiff, Ms. Ellison, was a IRS employee, and she had a coworker who was sending her MASH notes, and really creepy MASH notes,
mm-hmm.
and following her around, and she reported it to her supervisors, and they wouldn't do anything about it. And they said, well, you know, he's got a crush on you. Don't worry about it.
And she construed that as a hostile workplace, and she prevailed. Terrence, we have to wrap it up. We're at the top of the hour here. But thanks for the heads up and for the information, and I appreciate it.
Okay, no problem.
And for listening there in Pittsburgh, California, for calling in. Good to hear from you. 56 minutes past the hour. In our next hour, we're going to talk about our book, Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion, that we're writing online, on the air, here the third hour of every Friday. I'll be talking about framing and chunking up and chunking down in the first half hour, and then we'll take your calls on this and the whole topic in the second half hour. 57 minutes past the hour, we'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. I'm writing a book right now called Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. And we're doing it week by week here on the radio. And this week, the topic that we're going to talk about is framing and chunking. Most people are familiar with the word framing. They're not all that familiar with the word chunking. And a lot of people don't understand what either means, and there's a relationship between the two. Let me give you an example. of framing, first of all. Newsons U.S., the website, we box Fox, so you don't have to. You know, these folks who are kind of vigilant about, you know, they watch Fox so we don't have to. This is a story reported by Judy, one of their reporters, reacting to the idea of a powerful woman. Fox News on Thursday, January 4, 2007, marked the occasion of the swearing-in of the first woman as Speaker of the House, with coverage that mocked her authority and depicted her policy disagreements with other members of Congress as petty jealousies typical of women. Fox and Friends began its coverage not with a story about the history-making aspects of Nancy Pelosi's swearing-in as Speaker, but with a story about Representative Jane Harman, the Democrat from California, still being upset after Pelosi failed to reappoint her as chair of the House Intelligence Committee. Fox and Friends co-hosts Steve Doocy, Gretchen Carlson, and Andrew Napolitano blamed Pelosi's dumping of Harman on Harman's willingness to work with Republicans, Fox speak, for failure to challenge Bush administration's intelligence abuses. As the trio discussed, now here's where we get into the frame. And what Fox is doing is they're establishing a frame for Nancy Pelosi, not as Speaker of the House, not as somebody who is defending America's liberty, not as a great stateswoman, none of those things, but rather as a petty and jealous female. Here, as the trio discussed the story, Fox News displayed a banner reading, quote, "Congress catfight," end quote. This is what the Fox News banner said as they're talking about Nancy Pelosi on the day she's being signed in, sworn in. The term catfight is a belittling term often used. I'm reading from Jane's piece here in Newsons.us. The term catfight is a belittling term often used to ridicule disagreements among women, casting them as fights among animals, especially an animal that is often seen as fickle and hard to understand like a cat. Saying a disagreement among women is a catfight is akin to saying that women are less than human and their disagreements are based on something other than rationality, intellect, or principle. Men do battle. Women have catfights. This is what Jane is writing over at Newshounds.us. This subtle swipe was not the end of Fox's News' efforts to belittle the new speaker. In a segment on Pelosi's comments that by becoming speaker, she was now the most powerful woman in America, Doocy read her quote about breaking through a marble ceiling and then mocked her by saying, "All rise, Nancy Pelosi takes control," as the music of Pomp and Circumstance played in the background. When Doocy mentioned her name again later in the program, Fox News again played the same music. At one point, Fox News also displayed a banner beneath video of Pelosi, which read, "Stepping Down." And in the second hour of the program, Fox and Friends, the trio repeated their discussion of the Harman-Pelosi disagreement, complete with the congressional catfight banner. Later, going into the break, Napolitano teased, "Is the new Speaker of the House really the most powerful woman in America?" Doocy says, "She says so," suggesting there's reason to doubt it. After the break, the co-host interviewed Michael Barone of U.S. News & World Report about Pelosi's power. He confirmed that her power is considerable. She's third in line for the presidency. She could set the agenda in the House. And yet, continuously through this two-hour show, Fox News kept establishing this frame of Nancy Pelosi as basically being a petty person, largely because she's a woman. Over at Fox Newshounds.us, they conclude the piece by saying, "Pelosi did not fit the mold of fair and balanced femininity espoused in Fox News. Women are either innocent victims like Natalie Holloway, or they are whores like the accuser in the Duke LaCrosse rape case." And this is one of the primary conservative frames, is, you know, the Madonna or whore frame, that women have to fit in one of those two categories, whereas men can be anything. Right, which takes us back to that Supreme Court case that I was reading from earlier. So the whole concept of a frame is that it in a way is at one level an anchor. That is to say, when you bring up the frame, it brings up all kinds of stuff associated with it. And at the same, you know, for example, Social Security. Social Security is a program. It's also a frame. And it means different things to different people. Tax relief. This is a classic frame. In order to have relief, you have to have an affliction. Right? I'm going to be relieved of my headache. But you don't talk about relief of something positive generally. You don't say, I think I'll go to the restaurant and have some hunger relief. I suppose you could, but, typically instead you say, I'm going to go eat. I'm going to enjoy the meal. It's going to be good. So the frame defines the issue. And what's really important is to outframe the framers. For example, right-wingers say, Social Security, it's broke. Well, that's one frame. Social Security program is running out of money. It's partially accurate. But another frame that would be much more powerful, but which the news media has been unwilling to engage in, would be Social Security is having problems because Ronald Reagan started spending the Social Security Trust Fund money, and every president since him has continued to spend the Social Security Trust Fund money on tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. Your Social Security money went to tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. That would be, another way of framing it. So one of the most important things about frames is knowing that 90% of the battle in politics is defining and maintaining the frame. And the minute you step into your opponent's frame, the moment that you start arguing about, well, our tax relief is better than your tax relief, as opposed to, hey, taxes are the price of admission to civil society. You don't want to pay taxes. What, you're a freeloader? We just reframed it, right? I mean, I'm pleased to have streets that don't have potholes. I'm pleased to have police departments that protect, ideally that protect me as a citizen. I'm pleased to have a fire department that's going to make sure that my house doesn't burn down. And I'm pleased to pay the taxes to do that. Now, obviously, there are some things I'd rather not be paying taxes for. There's policies that I don't like. But, for example, the war in Iraq. But the reality is that as a citizen of this country, it's not a, I think I'll take this and I won't take that kind of thing. We're all in this together. I mean, here's the frame of democracy now. Now, in the context of frames, the most powerful frames are frames that involve values. And this is where chunking up and chunking down comes along. Chunking up is where you take something to the bigger picture. Chunking down is where you start going down into the minutia. And those of you who are longtime listeners to the program know, perhaps you didn't know it at the level of, the conscious level, but you will now and you'll notice it in the future, that one of the primary strategies that I use when I'm debating conservatives is to try to chunk up. In other words, you get somebody on the program and they'll start out talking about, we really shouldn't have, well, for example, yesterday, our debate with Yarnbrook, we shouldn't have the government involving itself in whether or not fast food restaurants are in children's hospitals. Now, we could have limited the argument to that. I could have simply debated that. That's a small chunk. And it's a relatively small frame. And the frame that Yarn was using for it was government should not involve itself in private activity. Hospitals are private institutions. People are private people. Government shouldn't involve itself. That's actually a very large and very powerful frame. So what he was doing was making an argument at a micro level, a small level, to invoke a macro frame, a frame at a very large level. So I then took it to a frame at a very large level, which is, don't we as a society have an obligation to protect our vulnerable kids who see a McDonald's in a hospital, and it causes them to think that healing and McDonald's are somehow synonymous? You get it? This is chunking up. 16 minutes past the hour.
You can cry if you want tonight. You can blame all your wounds on the world if you like. You can drink from the bottle, no ice and no glass. You can lie in the morning and say it's your last, but you won't stop there. No, you won't stop there.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. If you have questions about this whole issue that we've been talking about now for about a month, I think, 3-4 weeks, maybe 5 weeks we've been doing this, the cracking the code, the art and science of political persuasion. If you have examples you'd like to share with us or questions about how it works or any of the conversations that we've had in previous weeks, what I've been doing up to this point is basically taking an hour and doing a monologue. And today what I'd like to do is open up the second half hour, you know, right after the next break, to your calls. And let's get a dialogue going about this. Our number 1-866-440-8466, your thoughts on that. One of the keys to how framing works, there's two concepts here that we're talking about, framing and chunking up and chunking down. One of the keys to how framing works has to do with the selectivity of attention. There's a basic premise that's used in both marketing, politics, and hypnosis. And we'll talk about this in one of our future chapters when we talk about hypnotic language and the use of hypnosis, is that people can only attend to 7 things at the same time, plus or minus 2. The human variation is the plus or minus 2. Some people can only attend to 5 things. Some people can attend to 9 things. But nobody, for all practical purposes, can attend to fewer, is incapable of attending to fewer than 5 or capable of attending to more than 9. And so we all, because we can all pay attention to 7 plus or minus 2 things, for example, right now, I'm attending to, you know, thinking about what I'm talking about, what I'm going to say next. I'm attending to the microphone in front of me and noticing that, and the sounds in the headphones coming back at me. To Greg, and Mary in the next room on the other side of the, you know, I'm attending to my environment. I'm attending to sitting up straight, not falling over. I mean, there's a certain point at which, and all of you are as well. Each of us is attending to the various things that, you know, have to do with homeostasis, our body temperature. If you're driving, you're attending to the driving. So at a certain point, we reach a point where, okay, that's it. We can't attend to any more than that. I can't read the email that's in front of me at the same time that I can read the chat room, at the same time that I can think about what I'm going to talk about, at the same time I can notice Gary and Mary, and then at the same time that I can see the TV screen going, you know, there's a certain overload point. And because of that, what we do is we create a selective form of, amnesia is the wrong word, of we have selective focus, selective attention. It's part survival strategy and it's part efficiency strategy. It makes us more efficient at attending to things if we can focus on just a few things at one time. And so the key to framing is to pick out a few of those 7 plus or minus 2 things. See, an effective frame can't have more than a couple of components to it. It has to be real simple. In fact, this is one of the problems that progressives and liberals very often have in articulating their worldview, because their worldview is relatively complex. It's one of the appeals of a conservative worldview, which is highly simple. Well, this is the role of men, this is the role of women, they would say, for example. Oh, Nancy Pelosi, if she has power, she must be getting into a catfight. Right, because they have that very simplistic worldview. Not a lot of pieces to it. Their big chunk, if he has a chunk up, their large view of who people are in the world, is really a very, very small and simple one. Right? So one of the keys to effective framing, to competent framing, is to have that frame be very simple, and to really powerful framing can be to just turn things on their side. For example, I just got an email from Random House, my publisher, the publisher of three of my books, and it's from their PR department about their new titles,
and, you know, just send it out to talk show hosts. Dinesh D'Souza takes on the most talked about, dissected topic of our day and gives us a startling, controversial reading on the causes and possible cures for the war on terror. Now, the frame that this book is putting forward is that liberals are responsible for 9/11. That's the frame. The title is The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11. You say, what? That's crazy. But notice how quickly they lay this out. D'Souza reveals that the war on terror is not as many have claimed being waged by Christian conservatives. He asserts that the war truly is a war against Islam, and the leaders of America's cultural left are leading the charge. People like Hillary Clinton, Ted Kennedy, Barney Frank, Bill Moyers, and Michael Moore are responsible for 9/11 in two ways: by fostering a decadent and depraved American culture that angers and repulses other societies, especially traditional and religious ones. Okay, so the first part, the first big chunk of this frame is that we had it coming, as Pat Robertson said. And second, and by promoting at home and abroad an anti-American attitude that blames America for all the problems of the world. In other words, anytime we engage in self-examination, anytime we criticize our leaders or our government, we are causing the rest of the world to think poorly of us and hate us. And so anybody who does either of these two things is responsible for 9/11. It's nuts, but that's their frame. 27 minutes past the hour.
You better listen, my brother, 'cause if you do, you can hear there are voices still calling from the ear. They'll cry across the ocean, and they'll cry across the land, and they will till we all come to understand. None of us are free. None of us are free. None of us are free. One of us in chains. None of us are free.
Yeah, see, there's a chunk for you. That's a real substantial frame. None of us are free if one of us is in chains. That was the argument that was made by the abolitionists back in the early days. I mean, this is the concept of a frame. A good frame actually induces selective attention. In other words, it causes people to attend to some things and not attend to others. The frame of death tax, for example, causes people to forget about the fact that that what we're talking about is taxing a transaction, a passage of cash between two individuals, one of whom has died. But nonetheless, it's a transfer of wealth, it's a transfer of cash. And in our society, we have a consensus that if we transfer wealth to anybody that's over within families, if it's over $10,000, that's called a taxable event. Then when the money comes to a person, it's called income. But by calling it a death tax, then we say, oh, gee, you know, it creates a kind of an amnesia around all of those issues. Our number, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Rama in Williamstown, Vermont.
Hey, Tom.
The guy who helped us start this program and our very first producer.
Yeah, and actually, as always, it was a pleasure to be there to help things get started, you know.
Well, thank you.
I want to say, first off, this part of this show segment has really become like a thing I love listening to. I find the subject totally fascinating. But I've taken up doing a little bit of substitute teaching, and while I'm up there, I have some free time, and in my pursuit of trying to at least do the job a little bit better as I read pretty much whatever sits there on the desks. And a book I came across on one of the desks was Literacy with an Attitude, if I remember the title correctly. And I'm going to add, this is the question I want to ask, and then I'll explain why, because it comes from this book. Is there a difference in all of this framing and discussion, is there a difference in how you talk about issues according to the economic class of the person you're talking to?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Not just the economic class. I mean, the reality is that we are a multicultural society, and there are not only are there the larger subcultures, you know, that have to do with wealth or have to do with race or have to do with regionality, but there are also micro subcultures. I mean, you can define subcultures at the level of family, at the level of workplace, there's no homogenous thing that is culture.
or even that is American culture.
Okay, and I guess to cut it short then, that's essentially what the author there says, is, you know, people from the lower classes tend not to move around and thus tend to be more suggestive with their discussion. Richer classes that tend to get out and deal with people outside their community tend to talk a lot more specifically because they need to get understood by people that don't have a shared experience with them.
Well, that's, you know, one of the predicates of most language is a whole bunch of assumptions. I mean, you say anything, and there's a, you know, this is why we have pronouns. You say, you know, he went to the bank. You know, well, who's the he? You know, or for that matter, where's the bank? We're not typically in any given sentence. There's all kinds of assumptions built into the sentence that have to do with what preceded it, what followed it, and the social context or the discussional situational context of it. But yeah, it's I would suggest to you that if you're establishing frames or if you're chunking up or down, for the purpose of political persuasion, you absolutely want to take into consideration who is your target audience, who is it that you want to attach to this frame. I mean, for example, the death tax, that whole death tax thing, they were not trying to use that frame to influence the people who are going to pay an inheritance tax. That's like 0.1% of the American population.
Sure.
They wanted to use that frame to influence people who will never have to pay a so-called death tax.
Yeah.
They wanted to get them in on it and have them identify with it. Rama, got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call. Good point. Nicole in San Francisco, listening on the Quake. Hey, Nicole.
Hi. Listen, I just want to thank you because I have never had the ability, and I've always admired your ability, to talk to conservatives and keep giving logical arguments. I cannot help it. In the past, I have constantly let my emotions, because I get to the point of total befuddlement with them. I simply sit there and scratch my head and have nothing more to say.
Yeah.
So,
well, this is where the strategy that I'm talking about today is so useful, because I'm always asking myself, what's the bigger picture here? In other words, what's the bigger chunk? What's the large frame that we're really discussing? And once I can understand the frame that they're operating out of, I can understand, or I can create the counter frame and come back to it.
Are they consciously framing when they speak, or is it subconscious?
A few of them are consciously framing. Most conservatives and liberals, for them, and most people, I'd say, particularly in political debate, are really just doing sports, what I call sports. They're my team versus your team sort of thing. They're working off their talking points. They're working off a frame that was very, you know, either very carefully or very evolutionarily created for them by somebody else. There are some very conscious framers out there, though. You know, Frank Luntz, Newt Gingrich, these guys.
Carl Rove.
Carl Rove, absolutely. Very, very conscious of language and of frames. And, you know, at what level are they going to extract data to create the frames? And that's why in debating conservatives, I always try to, not always, but I generally try to step back one giant step from what the actual subject of the debate is to what is the larger chunk, what is the big frame that we're debating here. And then sometimes if you push that in various directions, you get to the obvious ridiculous, you know, the absurdities of it.
Right.
But, you know, that's my strategy is to, because I used to get emotional about this stuff. I mean, my beginning with political debate was when I was 15, 16 years old, and I started, my dad was a Republican, you know, I've told this story before. When I was 13 in 1964, he was the county chairman for the Republican Party, and I went door to door for Barry Goldwater. I mean, I had read John Stormer's None Dare Call It Treason. I knew the communists had taken over the State Department, and they were coming to get me. You know, a friend of my dad's took me to a John Birch Society meeting. My dad was never into that, but, you know, it's,
wow.
I mean, I was like, you know, the Republicans had me. And within 2 years, I'd say probably in part because of the Vietnam War, in part because I went off to college, I figured out that I didn't share that worldview. And I remember, you know, I used to have these knockdown, drag-out arguments with my dad that on one occasion, he got so angry that, you know, his response was, leave the house. I mean, he threw me out of the house one night, you know. And, you know, God bless him. I mean, you know, he immediately retracted it. But, I mean, that's – and both of us would just get so cranked up. And over the years, you know, my dad died last summer, just a few months ago. And he still – I mean, you know, the day he died, he was a Republican. But over the years, what we did was we figured out how to have these debates at the level of intellect, not at the level of I'm going to beat you up. You know?
But my grandmother was actually one of those Republicans, and I was closer to my grandmother than I was to my own parents. She was one of those Republicans. She said until the day she died, she would go and vote the straight Republican slate, the straight, without, and I said, without knowledge of issues, without knowledge of the candidates, without any knowledge at all. She was one of those dyed-in-the-wool Republicans, and I loved her still, but what are you going
to
do?
Yeah, but that, and that, I think it was a really good lesson for me. I learned that it is possible to have a political debate and not have blood on the floor afterwards, because we all have people like my dad in our lives, and we all have people who don't share our political perspective, and we have to figure out a way to have
conversations. But, Tom, I love this segment. Don't ever quit it. It educates me. It helps me. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you, Nicole, and thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Philip in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Philip.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Sure.
I'm a little confused, though, on the wording big chunks. I know it best as, like, the whole picture or the big picture. In other words, like, little chunks are like missions. You always establish missions, meet the objective or goal. And case in point, like, our goal is to make aware of a living wage for everybody. That's our goal. And by establishing little chunks or little missions by saying the economy is here to serve the people, and not the people to serve the economy, you know. So I'm thinking if you use
right,
the
that's the ultimate big chunk
picture.
Yeah, or a big picture. Yeah, it's a good point. And for visual people, you know, big picture is certainly a good phrase. But yeah, the whole discussion of living wage. And Philip, I'm sorry, your cell phone is like really creaky there, so I'm gonna have to drop you. But you made your point. You made it well. The living wage, the whole concept of a living wage, that, you know, that could be a large chunk, and it certainly can be a frame, but there's also a larger chunk or a bigger picture than that and a bigger frame than that, which is do we have an economy to serve society? That is to say, do we want to have an economic system, in this case regulated capitalism in the United States, do we want to have an economic system for the purpose of advancing the goals of society? Or do we have a society, do we breed people in order to be resources for those who control the economic system? And that's really increasingly one of the fundamental divides between conservatives and liberals. Conservatives view humans as resources and feel that they should get those resources as cheaply as possible, just like any other resource. And liberals view humans as humans and say, no, wait a minute. The purpose of the economy, the purpose of our economic economic institutions should ultimately be to serve all of us. 45 minutes past the hour. Speaking of my dad, this is the song we played at his funeral, his favorite song.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And special thanks, as always, to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to all the folks at Air America Radio, Andrew Dunn, Lauren Kirshner, Alex Goldmark, Clay Kaplis, Tim MacArthur, to Ben and Shelby at the White Rose Society and RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Special thanks. And thanks to my parents for birthing me. 51 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466. Our number, Charles in San Francisco, California, listening on the Quake. Hey, Charles.
Hi, thanks very much. I've just recently begun enjoying your show.
Thank you.
I want to talk about the framing issue, and I'd like to suggest that as much as I like the argument that you're making, for example, about freeloaders versus tax relief as two different frames, I think you and a lot of us are still falling into the trap of an even bigger Republican frame on taxes, and that is that you use the phrase at one point saying, you know, I like roads, and I like, you know, I like having good roads, I like police, and I don't mind paying my taxes. to have that stuff. And I think that, I think that's part of the trap, because I'm a progressive, but I hate paying taxes. And I think most progressives, well, most people could be persuaded that actually taxes are a necessary evil that we endure in order to have some of these other things that we like. And,
you know, I don't disagree with you, Charles. Here's, let me blow that frame apart, though. Let's chunk this one up even bigger. Just without telling me what your income is, let's just make up a magic income. Let's say that you make $50,000 a year, okay? For example. And, if you made $50,000 a year, what would your take home pay be after taxes? Maybe 35, 40, right?
Maybe, yeah.
Okay. So let's say it's 40,000. Now, If I was able to magically wave a wand and say, okay, no more taxes. There's no more taxes, period. We're going to figure out some other way to fund the government. We're going to do it with tariffs, for example. And so Charles no longer has to pay a tax. Your employer, who's been paying you $50,000 a year so that you can take home $40,000 a year, do you think that employer is going to continue paying you that $50,000 a year?
I think, Tom, the thing is, I don't think the answer to that matters, because what you're doing is you're getting into subtleties of arguments about microeconomics and about cash flows and so on, which fall back into the liberal trap, as you said, you know.
Too complex, too many chunks.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. We're fond of complex and subtle arguments, and what I'm saying is that at the very visceral level, as long as you as long as you include phrases like "I don't mind paying my taxes," a lot of people are just going to viscerally say, "Well, he's nuts." And
Okay, all right, point made.
I'm thinking of a talk I attended by Bill Clinton, in which he said, you know, the difference between conservatives and progressives is that, you know, progressives appreciate that there is a role for government. And I thought to myself, you know, Bill, as brilliant as you are falling into a Republican trap again, because I think the vast majority of Americans culturally prefer the idea of smaller government.
No, I disagree with that, Charles. Well, I think the vast majority of Americans have bought into that rhetoric as the result of 30 years of it being constantly drumbeat of it. But the fact of the matter is that Americans want their streets not to have potholes. They want their social security check to show up.
But you see, you're drawing a false dichotomy here. I'm not saying that I don't want good streets. I'm saying that I want the benefits. I want the benefits of well-run government, and sure. I will support institutions which bring those benefits, but government for its own sake is something which most Americans have a visceral negative reaction to, and that's the trap that the Republicans have us in. We need to focus on the benefits that it brings and avoid defending government per se or defending taxes per se, because those are losing frames.
Good point. Good point. Charles, thank you very much. Jane in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, Jane.
Yes, hello. You said a moment ago, I just wanted to add to the notion that you said that Republicans, or maybe it was capitalists, see humans as particularly as resources. And I would just add to that perhaps a little qualifier is that not all humans, you know, their own group, whatever the group that is, family or class or level of management, whatever it is, they don't see them as being capable of being exploited. And I think the fundamental flaw in their thinking, which we're all prone to, but theirs in particular, they're unabashed about the fact that they are by definition not egalitarian. They don't see humans as deserving what they have.
And the CEOs who are making hundreds of millions of dollars are looking at other CEOs making hundreds of millions of dollars, not thinking, oh, gee, there's a resource. They're thinking, hey, that's a member of my tribe.
Yeah, they don't mind. That's their flaw. You know, it's not that they see everyone as exploitable, but only certain people. And I think that's even a dire and more immoral stance.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all, Jane. Well said. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for listening. So we wrap up another week. We'll be back on Monday. Thanks so much for being here with us throughout this week. Noon to 3 Eastern, 9 to noon Pacific, and all things in between. And for Sue in London, what would that be? I don't know. Whatever it is. Thanks so much for being with us. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. We'll be back on Monday. And remember, democracy begins with you, my friends. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.